Welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's episode number 450. It is, isn't it? Seven. Yeah, I can do the numbers, right? My name's James Gilmore. Joining me today is Rick Cowley.
Hello.
And the return of Emily Soden.
I am back, mortals. Fear me.
Bloody hell, I think we may have made a bit of a mistake. She's gone for half a day and now she's gotten ideas way above her station. What's it like up there, Em? Hey, you've been hanging out on Firetop Mountain. Is this what this is all about?
Yeah, man. I went adventuring and I bossed through it. And I got riches and I got championship and people love me. And I slayed lots of things. And I'm just basically better than everyone.
Wow.
It's nice to feel that way for once.
Imagine self-esteem. Wow. I'm only joking. I'm great. How is everybody else today? I hope you're feeling well. It's very, very blowy here in the UK. So if you hear the occasional in the background, that's why. Because I've got my windows closed, but this wind, it laughs in the face of windows. Been up to anything exciting over the course of the week, fellas, apart from work?
Spider-Man!
Shut up. Good. Are we enjoying Spider-Man? I say we, I don't have it, but...
How can you not have Spider-Man? Everyone's got Spider-Man, James.
Because I don't like Ubisoft games, and I don't care who's the star of them.
It's not an Ubisoft game. What are you on about?
Yes, it is! Yes! It is, Rick. Don't go kidding yourself that it's not just a Ubisoft game with the Spider-Man in it. Do you have to climb towers?
Yes, you have to get towers.
Do you have to collect a load of random stuff?
It's Arkham Asylum, but with Spider-Man in it.
Basically.
Yeah. Well, Arkham City, more like. It's really good.
It is. It's genuinely very good. Like, I'm really not a Spider-Man person. I kind of bought it for when Matt got home from his holiday so that he'd, like, you know, have something to play. Because I'm a good girlfriend, nice. Okay?
You are lovely. You truly are the champion of champions up there on the mountain. Well done.
Thank you. Gracious and kind. And I played it like before we got back and I got kind of addicted to it.
Ooh.
I was like, yes, this Spider-Man I hear so much of, he's good.
I know, everyone seems to love it. I'm only being unnecessarily contentious because I haven't played it. But I'm fearful that I will pick it up and then immediately kind of get the same fatigue that I get with the other games. That involve collecting a billion, in this case it's backpacks, isn't it? 100 backpacks.
55 backpacks and it takes
about
half an hour.
Still too many backpacks for a young boy to have.
The collectibles are actually great because they just slowly eke them out over time. You don't have a map full of dots straight from the off. You have a map with some dots and then you get through the story and more dots open up and you can just clear up all the collectibles before you move on to the next story bit. Which I really like, and that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, I like that one as well. It's so nice to be kind of given these things in dribs and drabs rather than just thrown at you.
Mm. That does sound better. Still, I'm not getting it. I'm going to save myself for Red Dead Redemption 2. Because I'll have to get that on launch because the hype's going mad at the moment. And I admit, I'm getting slightly caught up in it.
That's fair, though. Red Dead is like another level. It's making other games tremble. That's how you know stuff's getting real.
Seems to be the case, but we're not going to be talking about the newest games to start off with this week. Oh no, because it's all about old games. Let's go retro. We're going to discuss briefly the PlayStation Classic announcement that appeared alongside the NES Switch Online connection, which was also revealed. We're going to give you the keys to the Dark Souls Remastered online test, which is happening this weekend. Plus a whole bunch of new games, including Where the Shadows Slumber, Cube Escape Paradox, Ammo Pigs, and more, and an interview with the developers of Oceanhorn and Oceanhorn 2, which is looming over the horizon, and they're going to tell us all about how it's going and why you should all be very excited for it. But first, the news. We've had the NES Mini. We've had the SNES Mini. Now, let's get our wallets prepared for the PlayStation Classic. Sony has jumped on the, hey, remember that old console? Well, here's a tiny version, bandwagon, with their new announcement. Coming December 3rd, 2018, for £89 or $99, you will be able to get hold of the PlayStation Classic, a little mini version which has got a HDMI port in it of the original PS1 or PSX or however you want to call it. It's 45% smaller, it'll come preloaded with 20 games, and is anyone else getting a bit sick of this?
Oh yeah.
I don't want to be like negative, right? But the NES thing, when that first happened and Nintendo did it, everyone was like, oh my god, this is amazing. The tiny little, so cute, and I want it in my childhood in a box. And it flew off the shelves and success. Then SNES Mini, and everyone was like, oh, and I was more excited about that one because SNES was more my era. So I was like, oh yeah, I want that. Brilliant. Yeah, brilliant. Didn't get one, but wanted it. Now we've got the PlayStation Classic. We already know that Sega has done a version of the Mega Drive at one point. It was kind of crap. And I know that they're working on a new one to go in line with this thing. And it's now becoming a trend. PlayStation is following Nintendo with this one, and you can just guarantee everyone else is going to do the same thing. This is now starting to smack of like a slightly cynical nostalgia profiteering in a way that irritates me because, specifically with Sony have been the ones who have been very kind of lax on their backwards compatibility, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah, no, they're not great. The one thing that like really annoys me, and the one thing that I've always missed on the PlayStation 4 as opposed to the PlayStation 3, is when on the PlayStation 3 they brought out their classics range.
Yeah.
So you could buy old PlayStation games and play them on the PlayStation 3, but the 4 doesn't have that system at all, and I never understood why.
Yes. Well, I mean, the problem is highlighted when we got the original PlayStation 3 launched, because obviously the PS1 was its own thing, then you had the PS2, there weren't really any PS1 ports onto PS2, they didn't really do that back then. But then when you had the PS3, it launched with backwards compatibility, the original big, massive tank model with the Spider-Man
fat
font on
PH
it.
Fat.
Yeah, the fat one. Which I had, and you could actually just put in old discs into that, and it would work. Backwards compatibility, amazing. And then every model subsequently that they released, every updated version, they removed it because, in their own words, I've heard red quotes where they're going like, "Yeah, it's not really a thing. People don't really want to play old games, and you know, backwards compatibility is not a big deal, and it's so much hard work and so difficult to do, and all these other excuses which just reek of no, absolute lie. You're doing it so people have to buy your old console." And this seems to support that one, where it's like, oh yeah, people don't care about backwards compatibility. By the way, PlayStation Classic, you guys! Remember the past? Wasn't it great? You're like, hang on. It's all I'll say, so you won't include it in your console, but you will charge us £100 to get 20 games, only maybe 4 of which are worth a damn.
Yeah, it does reek. The annoying thing is, I didn't really care about the NES or SNES. And, you know, when the Mega Drive came out, of course, that was my childhood. I was kind of excited about it until my sister got it and I saw how crap the audio was. But it was like $40 or whatever it was, so it was not going to be the best quality. But the PlayStation 1 was kind of my primary childhood. Kind of when you have the most games to play and things. Like, that was Harry Potter 1 territory.
Yeah, yeah.
And we already kind of, it's kind of a given we won't get Spyro and Crash on it.
Probably not. Well, the ones that they've listed, they've only listed 4 or 5. So Ridge Racer Type 4, that's a really good one. Wild Arms and Jumping Flash, I'm not really familiar with them. But obviously biggies. Tekken 3, which is the Tekken that I played the most, so fair play. And Final Fantasy 7. Remember, Rick? Square Enix games re-released in different... Let's add another one to that list from last week, shall we? It's now going to be out on the PlayStation Classic as well.
4 of those 5 games are already available on PS1 Classics. On Vita and PS3. The only game that isn't is Tekken 3. But the only way to get Ridge Racer Type 4 is to buy it in a bundle with the original Tekken. Which I admit isn't a good Tekken. But you can still get a version of Tekken on an old console.
When they release these things, I get annoyed with myself for responding positively to it internally. You know what I mean? Like, I see the PlayStation Classic. A big bit of me wants this. Because I had a PlayStation. I love the PlayStation. It's like looking at your childhood. It's a cute little object. I kind of, if money were no object, I would go, I kind of want it. But the rest of my brain is like, no, you idiot, you don't. There's no need for you to get this. You can get it in all the other ways. Get it on the PlayStation 3. You're being ripped off now. You're having your childhood exploited. I should point out that people might be listening to this saying, why the hell are we discussing this? Because they've gone and done these mini bloody consoles, this now fits into our remit. Because the remit is Pocket Gamer, i.e. gaming things you can put in your pocket. And that is true of all these classic systems. These are portable consoles. You still need to plug them into a TV, but then that's the same thing, you know, when you're playing your Switch, you dock that into a TV and play it, but this is smaller than any of your Switches or anything like that, so this all counts now. It's portable gaming, isn't it? But I feel like it's just going to be an endless chain of these and with them being closed units, with them only being able to play what they're built with, so, you know, you're only going to get 20 games and boof, that's it, unless you hack the consoles. It's just like a bit, this isn't really the true emulation thing that we want, unless you go in there and hack it. And we've always talked about preserving history and the benefit of having, like, a uniform games library that you can always go back to and that will be constant, and there's a good reason for why emulators exist, because they genuinely preserve and keep old games alive for people who otherwise wouldn't be able to play them. This seems like this is more aesthetic than anything else. This is more so you could have a little PlayStation and look at it and go, oh, I remember that, I loved that, rather than it is for keeping games alive.
Truthfully, if they had made, I know it wouldn't have been as small, but if they had made a version of the PlayStation Classic where you could actually fit an old disc in it and it would play, that would be a completely different ball game for me personally. Because the Mega Drive, this is one thing I did think was really good about the Mega Drive that my sister bought. If you had an old cartridge, you could put it in the top and you could play it.
When you say the Mega Drive your sister bought, you mean she bought like a Mega Drive emulator classic thing?
Yeah, you know, like the one that came out in 2016?
Yes, the old one.
Flashback ones.
Yeah, the one that came with the inbuilt games.
It had a crap audio and video output. It had just the yellow composite cable output, right?
I had the yellow, white, and red output thingies. The funny thing is, when you put the cartridge in, the audio was fine.
And the audio was bad on what, the ones built in?
Yeah, like they just sounded really, really cheap.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that.
But the thing is, you could actually play your old games on there because we still have our stash.
Mm.
There's so much that could have been done with a PlayStation Classic that you can't do because it's not really real. It's like, its little open button is the one that helps you cycle through the games or something.
Yeah. The thing, console is just a little locked unit. It's just like a case for an emulator. That's all it is. A nice case, don't get me wrong. But it's a case for an emulator, and that's the thing. So if you want to be good, if you want to be lovely, just release the consoles again. Just do it with HDMI port in the back.
Mm.
That's the thing, because for me, that's the benefit of being able to plug it in and getting good HDMI sort of pure quality on it. That's what I'm after. Because when you have to use those yellow composite single video with the wavy lines and all that, all those like third party interim SCAR upscaling boxes that you get, which you can spend hundreds on, by the way, to try and like turn that picture into something that doesn't look awful, when all you just need is someone to just go, "That's wire it directly into HDMI, boom, done."
Mm.
That's what these do. But again, the little limited box of games is so frustrating, and I'm not going to buy this to play Final Fantasy VII again after we've all got 20 versions of it. Like, I can already play that with a HDMI connection. It's just a bit, just make things backwards compatible, you cowards. Which leads us on to the NES Switch Online Collection, which was a little bundle of games that you can now play on your Switch. Rick, you did the review. Is this a physical release, or was this a digital thing only?
This is a purely digital thing, which you can only access if you sign up for Switch Online.
Right.
Which is their new paid-for online service. So it's kind of like an additional bonus type thing. Rather than having sort of PlayStation Plus and Xbox Live Gold free games and stuff, they're just giving you lots of old NES games.
Do you download it? Do you stream it?
You download a separate app. But it's like 60 megabytes, so it's tiny.
Well, it's some NES games in it, so they're all less than a meg each. Yeah.
And then you can just play them offline, but you have to connect to the internet at least once a week to make sure that you have the right subscription kind of thing.
Okay.
Which is a bit daft. And then I've noticed that PlayStation have added the same thing for PS Now on the PS4.
But in terms of the actual emulation, how does it feel? Is it any good? Are these good versions?
Yeah, it's really good, actually, I thought. Every game plays really smoothly, apart from maybe Super Mario Bros. 3, but I don't remember the NES version of that playing particularly well, just with how things load on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Em played online for a little bit when it first launched, and you can do two-player online games, and that was actually worked pretty well. Didn't experience any particular lag, although there was a bit of a bug on Double Dragon. But it's an NES game, they're not going to be perfect.
Yeah.
They're going to keep adding more and more games to the system as they become available. So, like, I think Metroid comes out in November.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good that you have sort of this digital version that they can keep adding to rather than the physical box like the NES Classic that you can buy. And, of course, at some point, all the games on the NES Classic will probably end up on the Switch as part of this new thing. So,
and this isn't new for Nintendo, because they've done that with the Wii Shop, and you've always been able to buy the old games and, you know, get them in. It's a bit frustrating that in some cases your purchases didn't carry over into the new consoles, so again you're forced to buy it again, so there's always that cynical element. But the fact is, each individual company, be it Sony or Microsoft or whoever, know full well that you can very easily emulate the old games on the old consoles. The only, I guess, exception to that might be the PS3, because it does have weird architecture that is different from other consoles. But then, you know, so is the Wii and the NES, and they're all very different systems. So they can get emulators working, you could play your old games. But they kind of choose to package it in a way which is very limiting, only gives you a couple of games rather than access to the full library, and locks a lot of people out, a lot of people from the younger generation, let's say, who haven't had any exposure. They didn't grow up with a NES, so you can only play a few of them, but you will never get to play a lot of old classic games because either your parents have a console in the attic you can pull down, or you will never play it. And this is why everybody uses emulators to get access to these old games, and then the companies responsible get very cross about people using emulators. And it's like, well, if you give us access to the games, we'll download them, we'll play them, we'll buy them, in most cases, gladly. But you're only giving us a couple, a little smattering, and then telling us off when we try and play the rest. And it's just, it feels frustrating. It's now feeling like this, that was a nice novelty for the NES, and then the SNES as well. And now this is going to become a trend, and I feel like this isn't the greatest trend in terms of capturing games history for the modern generation, you know?
Indeed.
Let's talk about new games for a moment. So Dark Souls Remastered has its release date. It's coming out on Switch on October the 19th. But if you can't wait that long, this weekend, so beginning today as we record this, September 21st, from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. BST, you probably won't be able to play this in time, but network tests are going to begin for it. They will continue on the 22nd and the 23rd, so this weekend. So you can jump on right now if you're listening to this very quickly and get involved in the Dark Souls test. You can see how the whole thing runs. You can download the client off of the eShop if you want to go and give it a go. Is anyone going to step into Dark Souls the weekend to test the stability?
I might.
Really?
I want to see if I can handle it.
I'm fascinated to see how it runs on the Switch. I feel like we haven't really seen much of the Switch version.
Mm.
So go and download that if you are in any way interested, and October 19th for the full release. It is day one here at Pocket Gamer Connects Helsinki 2018. I am joined by Heikki, the creative director over there at Confox Bros. You've just come off from your first talk of the day.
Yeah, it was awesome.
How'd that go? Was it all right?
Yeah, it went really well with Short De Jong from Epic Games.
Good stuff. Yeah. And so you've been talking mostly about the game which you're going to be releasing sometime in the near-ish future, which is Oceanhorn 2, right?
Yeah, so we have been working on Oceanhorn 2 practically since the release of the first game back in 2013. First it went for 1 year of pre-production, and we finally started production in 2015 after releasing the Oceanhorn 1 on PC and other platforms. So yeah, we have been working on this for 3.5 years, so really exciting to get to the finish line.
No doubt. Well, the first one was very well received and has a top-down kind of perspective on the whole thing. The sequel, you've changed it to be like a third-person perspective where the camera tracks around behind the character. What was the idea behind changing that?
Yeah, I think for us game developers, we don't want to do the same game twice, so we want to challenge ourselves, and this project has been a really nice challenge to raise the bar for ourselves, what we can do, and the third-person camera, of course, and new game engine was a huge undertaking for us at the moment. It took some 1 year to prototype and find what the game really is about. So we are taking the Oceanhorn 2 into a little bit of new direction now. Since the beginning, basically, we have a party members joining on your quest. They share the story with you, the player, and can join the fights and puzzle solving. So there's a bunch of new stuff in the game, and this couldn't be done from the top-down perspective.
No, but you introduced like different wrinkles into the development there. So with a fixed camera, obviously it kind of tracks around of its own accord, and all you have to worry about is that simple movement.
Yeah.
Whereas now you're dealing with twin sticks, essentially, aren't you?
Yes.
So independent camera control, and then on a touchscreen, it's more familiar now. People are more used to doing that.
Yeah,
but that's its own kind of challenge, getting those controls feeling
right.
It was
a discovery for ourselves. We had this feeling that we can do a really good console quality controls for touchscreen, and I think we have been successful in that. the interface is clean and the gameplay is fun. I think it works out fine. I think players will find it really responsive.
Okay. The talk you just came out of, you were discussing using the Unreal Engine to build the game.
Yes.
And specifically, there was reference about the way in which you build it for multiple platforms, and you showed video and you showed visuals of the game running on a PC and the game running on mobile, and how it's pretty much identical, really. Yeah, like, how do you manage that?
It uses the same assets, and everything is done for the kind of high end in mind. We don't use separate low polygon models, for example, for mobile, but we aim to do the high fidelity assets right from the beginning for the mobile version. So everything that goes into the game, the shaders and game code and everything, we make sure it works on mobile as well as on PC. So we feel like the mobile gamers have always earned the console quality titles, and that's what we set up to do. And I think we have been pretty successful in that.
Well, there are fewer and fewer premium games around nowadays, and the original Oceanhorn was a premium game, you know, launched premium price, and the sequel, I don't know if you've decided on a payment model yet or what it's going to be, but fewer and fewer games are appearing, and people consider it kind of a slightly more niche market, the premium market. I don't know, are you planning to go premium? Have you made the decision yet?
The game is going to be a premium game, all the way, just like the first game. It's going to be fixed price right from the beginning, and we're going to maintain that price point, and I'm sure it's going to work out fine. Like, Oceanhorn 1 is still selling well on the App Store, and we are seeing this premium perspective from this franchise's point of view, and I think it is something. There are players who are looking forward to games like this and expecting the premium games to go on in the middle of this freemium market. So,
do you think you snuck in there just under the wire when it comes to that first one? Because I think you're right. I think people will pay premium price for the sequel, and it will do well, because the first one was very popular and people were a little bit easier with the idea of premium back then. So they will, if it was a new game, a completely new IP starting from scratch, do you think you would have the same success, or do you think it would be more of a gamble going premium?
I don't know. It's hard to go to that perspective, really, coming from the success of first Oceanhorn game. Yeah. I think it's also what the game tries to tell you, and we are trying to make the console quality game that is going to be released on multiple platforms. So I think that speaks for the people expecting for a premium game, and I think it would work also for new IP. I don't know.
Lastly, what's the biggest challenge you find developing for mobile specifically? Is it the play length sessions that people expect, shorter loops? Is it their control schemes? Like, what's the biggest thing that you have to get right to nail it?
I think it is all about those things. The play length session and controls, you need to make sure those things are done right. And I think we have been mobile game studio for 8 years. We have been working on mobile games long before that, so I think all this comes from the kind of gut feeling when designing the game, really, that and something that is also, like I said before, a discovery for us developers. We are playing the game all the time, so what is the kind of feedback we get ourselves from those, and I think it came to that, and we started to nail the kind of level size and the chunks of adventure you're having into these segments. But you're correct, it's all about those things.
Josh. And finally, release dates. Do you have any idea when it's going to be ready for the public?
Yeah, I think we're hitting the finish line here, so okay. I hope it's going to be within a year. That's all
within
I can
a year.
Say. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's give ourselves a little bit of room there, because we're self-funded developers. We can concentrate on the game as much as we like. On the other hand, we feel that our fans who want to get their hands on this. Mm. So we're constantly working hard to get the game done as fast as possible. But Yeah, there are limits for a six-man team. I hope we can make it.
Excellent. Well, best of luck with the last run of development and look forward to seeing the finished product.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And about this week, Life is Strange Before the Storm dropped yesterday, 2 days ago. And it is available on iOS, but iOS only at the moment. We are sure Android is to follow fairly shortly. This is the prequel game that was released before the original Life is Strange and follows Chloe on her adventures, her and Rachel, and that feeds into the story in Life is Strange. Did anyone else play through this?
Yeah, on PS4. I hated it.
Ooh, okay, right, I'll get to this in a minute. Did you play Life is Strange or the first one?
I played Life is Strange. I still got to get round to Before the Storm, and I felt mostly positive about it.
Okay. You hated it, Rick. Why
I hated
did you hate
it? I loved the original Life is Strange because it didn't really know what it was doing with the story, and that was kind of glorious. It ebbed and flowed and changed in ways, and they fixed things and they delayed the games and stuff like that. Mm. And they sort of responded to how players were playing the game, kind of thing. With Before the Storm, they had an agenda, and they went in and they went kind of like, this is the story that you're going to experience, and your choices don't really change anything. So, I don't want to spoil it too much, is the problem.
No, I know, it's tricky, isn't it?
But, like, the sort of central element of, like, the relationship between Chloe and Rachel is geared in a very specific way, and you can avoid doing it that way, but then it feels like you're ignoring the actual prequelness and you're not playing the game properly.
I think there's a bit of that with Life is Strange, though. I mean, right down to the ending choice, which, I mean, I don't really want to spoil it, but there is a clear right choice to that ending. And if you choose the other ending, if you go what people would argue would be the selfish route, the kind of ending reflects, like, clearly they haven't spent as much time on this ending because there is one obvious ending, you absolute monster. You've obviously got the problem of prequelitis, which everything has, where it's like Max is a sideline character, you see a little bit at the end. So you know that, like, for example, no point is Max going to turn up and then die. Like, you know, there are certain things that you know that are set in stone because it's a prequel, and that's always a problem with prequels. However, I loved this one. I was very worried about it. I thought it was going to spoil something I really liked. And in the end, it weirdly added to it in a way that almost changed the relationship between Max and Chloe in the original game for me. I now view that relationship very differently because of this one.
Mm.
And I quite liked that change, whereas maybe, I guess, you didn't.
I just feel like it was kind of a lot of different elements that didn't quite work together. There's a few story beats in there that were quite fun, but they didn't really fit the tale that it was trying to spin. The core relationship was way too forced. All the stupid sort of side crime stuff that kept happening felt really weird and dumb, particularly in the third episode of it. And the only thing I actually enjoyed was, like, the epilogue.
Oh, yeah.
Super prequel with Max and Chloe playing together, which I thought was really sweet and definitely added to the game. And I would have liked to have seen more stuff like that rather than focusing on Chloe, who I don't think was a particularly strong character in the first place.
Oh, I like Chloe. She sucks. That's why I like her. She's the friend that everybody has. He's just like, for God's sake, come on, get it together. But, you know, if you've had experience with those people, you can't help but sort of root for them despite their self-destructive tendencies. And the voice change I was worried about because they got the new voice actor in because of the voice actor's strike.
Yeah.
They couldn't get the other one in. And I was like, oh, no, they're going to change her. I really warmed to her and actually think she did great, Chloe. So it surprised me in a bunch of ways, I guess. The way it's released on iOS, it's free to play. So you can download the app. The episodes are available to buy via in-app purchases. I don't know if they give you like a bit of the first episode for free because I haven't actually downloaded it because it doesn't run on my devices. You're going to need at least an iPhone 7, at least, in order to run this thing. So be warned before you go in and download it. But Life is Strange Before the Storm out right now. iOS only, Android to follow. What else have we got on the iOS? Where Shadows Slumber. Here's one that I played. You've played this a bit, Rick?
Yeah. I'll let you explain it.
Okay. This is a game all about light. The way that it works is you play a little character who's wandering around an isometric environment holding a lantern. There are lots of pillars and other objects in this environment. As you move, the light moves with you and casts a shadow. So if you walk past a pillar, the shadow kind of tracks across the screen like a second hand tracking across the face of a clock. When that shadow wipes across objects, it might change those objects. So you might have a bridge there with a massively smashed out midsection. And as the shadow passes over it, when it reveals itself on the other side, the bridge is magically rebuilt. You're like, oh, brilliant. So then you charge across the bridge, but as you do so, you accidentally walk in front of another pillar, which wipes another shadow over, and now it's broken. Ah, so what do? You have to work out where to go, where to move, which shadow bit to move first, and that's the basic principle of the game. It's taking lots of cues from Monument Valley, I think, in terms of the way it's presented. I don't think it's anywhere near as pretty as Monument Valley. I actually didn't like the art style as much. I think it looks a bit weird. What I did like is that mechanic itself is neat. It opens itself up for a lot of interesting wrinkles to throw at you. So, for example, there are switches where you can elevate or raise platforms by pressing a button. You can even do the Monument Valley thing of just putting your finger on some columns and just dragging them up and down. And this will create objects on the horizon of the game, if you like. So you'll be able to make new shadows where you couldn't make them before. Likewise, you'll find some buttons that will activate some bridges and pillars and objects within the world, but also things that will turn lights on and off. And you can, for example, preserve areas that you've changed by moving the shadow over it, then it will rebuild the bridge. And then if there's a light on that bridge, you can turn that light on so that when the shadow passes over it, it will avoid that section of the bridge because it remains lit because you've turned on a little street light. Stuff like that. So it's got a lot going for it, I think. It's really dark. And I don't mean that in a light pun sort of way. I mean it's grim.
Yeah, it's really weird in that sense.
It gets quite twisted because I play these games to, you know, record them for the video reviews. And when I'm doing that, I generally keep the volume very low and it's playing off a TV off to one side. When I watch the footage back on this one, there's like a couple of scenes where it's very near the beginning where your guy gets like set upon by these creatures.
And it's like, when that happened, I was like in the back of my mind, like, I'm being beaten up by furries right now. This is not
a stupid game. Because your guy's holding a lantern and it's just like, oh, he's got a white globe head and, you know, very like low poly sort of thing. But then these creatures that are attacking you, they look like animals, only they're walking on, you know, two legs. So it looks like maybe people with animal heads on. It is a bit furry. But they like grab you and start beating you unconscious. And your boy is screaming.
God.
Like, It's really harrowing. I was like, Jesus Christ, this is dark. But yeah, so I'm not super keen on the art style, and I think it's a little bit rough around the edges. But I think the core mechanic is really cool and interesting, and the puzzle stuff is smart, and so I really like that aspect of it. How do you feel about it, Rick?
Yeah. I don't know, I didn't really enjoy it. It was doing too much that had been done before with Monument Valley, but then it added too much more. What I liked about Monument Valley was how simple it was, but how complex it could get using its own simplicity.
Mm.
And this sort of like built on top of that half simple, half complex stuff with an extra mechanic. And I was just like, oh, I just don't want to think about this. I like Monument Valley because I like the simple controls and the going through the things and working out the puzzles and feeling like a boss. Whereas this kind of felt like I stumbled across the solution to the puzzle and didn't feel particularly clever when I did it. And I got beaten up by furries three levels in, which I thought was just really stupid.
It's an informative life experience. I'd say I thought it was odd, and then I heard the screams, and then I like the fact that it's bizarrely dark. But
yeah.
This is an expensive game. This is the thing. It's £4.99, $4.99. That might be a bit of a push, because I don't think it's quite as polished as you might expect from something like that. But there is something to it. Watch the video review if you're unsure. Read a Harry's review over on Pocket Gamer. But Where Shadows Slumber, I should say, is the name of the game. Em, you mentioned you'd been having a quick go on something. What have you been playing?
I've been playing another rehash of the Warlock of Firetop Mountain. It was weird, actually. It was like a mixture of narrative adventure, like that classic game book style.
Yeah.
But also board game.
It sounds a bit like the fighting fantasy games that they've been releasing on PC.
Yeah, no, it is. It does feel a little bit like that. And the combat is tactical. Turn-based, I mean.
Okay, what's this on? Is this on...
This is on Nintendo Switch.
Switch, okay, all right then.
I went in not really expecting much, because game books can be a little bit hit or miss with me.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of started playing, I chose, you know, the badass heroine, obviously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, started off in your trial to Firetop Mountain to get the Eye of Cyclops, I think this one was. You start off with three or four heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you play the game, the more heroes you can unlock, and each hero has its own kind of quest.
Right.
So it doesn't matter how many times you go into the mountain with however many heroes, you'll always have something a little bit different. which is really cool. And you've got three lives, essentially.
Right. So is it just text blocks still coming up? Are you wandering around on a map? Like, what does it look like?
So each area you go to, like, kind of comes out of nowhere and just sort of evolves.
Mm-hmm.
And you're this token person, like a little counter.
Oh, okay.
So it just kind of moves your little counter around the board as you go. It's just really lovely.
That's very similar to what Inkle did with Sorcery. You just were represented by a little, like a lead figurine that would sort of drift around the screen.
Yeah, basically. It's definitely got that kind of feel to it. I think it was made by Tin Man.
Yeah, that sounds about right. They do a lot of those game books.
Yeah, but it was just nice. And the combat, actually, usually I'm not much of a turn-based combat kind of girl. I just find it... I'm just not smart enough for that sort of stuff sometimes. But their battles were small enough and engaging enough that you felt, like, able to do it regardless of your ability, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all, like, counters and checkers, and you've got to be really, clever about where you move. And it was just very good. I think it's really quite expensive, but it's definitely worth the money.
Yeah, okay. Again, I'm always cautious because we've had so many different versions of, like, Sorcery pulled on those books. You have the Fighting Fantasy Legends and Legends Portal series, which is also rehashing those books. And so they're getting a lot of mileage out of these handful of 80s books they keep redoing in different packages. All right, then. So the full name of that is?
The Warlock of Firetop Mountain Goblin Scourge Edition, I think.
Wow. All right, then. Goblin Scourge Edition. That's metal. Cool. Okay. You can get that for Switch at the minute, then. Warhammer Age of Sigmar, jumping back onto iOS and Android for a moment. Has anyone had a bang on this one? The second of the two Warhammer Age of Sigmar games in as many weeks?
Nope.
All right, then. So it's Clash Royale.
Yay.
Done with the Warhammers as very, very slick. It is effectively exactly the same game with just a couple of tiny little variations. The main difference here being that the heroes and characters that you're pulling on are obviously from the 40K universe, from the Warhammer universe, the Sigmar bit of it. Differences are it's not done from that straight top-down football pitch style perspective. It's done from a more isometric perspective, but it's all fully lovely 3D. You can move the camera around. Presentation is so impressive. Like, I played it a little bit this morning, and damn, it is. They've spent an immense amount of time on this. It is slick as hell. I loved the animations and the way it all plays out, but you're still just, you know, grab a card, drag it out, drop it onto the screen. You've got little towers that represent, that stand in front of your immediate champions or kings, you know, what would be a king in Clash Royale. And they just wander up and they fight, and it's exactly the same mechanic, only it's really, really lush. Few differences, you can play hero cards that march out across the screen, and there's this door that sits in the middle of the battle arena. If you can get three heroes past that door, then boom, you get like an extra card or extra attack or something. I forget how they described it. So they're little bits, but basically it's exactly the same thing, but it's really a flashy version of it. I think that Harry did the full review of it, and you've got a two-lane system more in this one. You get a bit more tactical play off the back of that, but it's not quite as well balanced as Clash Royale is at the minute. So when you start some games, you kind of get about two goes in and like, oh no, I'm dead. I already know that I am dead. That's something that might get balanced out later, because I don't think Clash Royale was as perfectly balanced at the beginning either. But there it is. It's free to download on iPhone, iPad. If you even like Clash Royale a bit, I would suggest checking it out just to see that game running, but with incredible graphics. And obviously, if you're a Warhammer fan, then you're in. So, Age of Sigmar Realm War is the name of it, and that's free iPhone, iPad. A few other things. Ammo Pigs, which is a side-scrolling... I'm trying to work out whether this is aping 16-bit or 8-bit. It looks a bit more 8-bit, I suppose. But it's a pixel art side-scrolling platformer in that Ravenous Games frame. It's not as good. I've played some of this, and I've fallen through the bottom of the screen twice. Which, yes, it does make it remind me of old consoles, so you could call it authentic, but also I would just call it irritating. And the controls feel a little bit wonk on mobile. I think we gave it a bronze and said, it's good and it's hard and all that business, but I think there are a bunch better versions of this game you can download on mobile. Again, we will direct you to the Ravenous Games. For that, they've done loads of excellent ones. You've got another Rusty Lake game, which I actually accidentally played for about 45 minutes yesterday because it was quite, I just got quite into it. This one's called Cube Escape Paradox. And it's kind of like an escape the room thing where you start out in a room and you can just like spin around the center of it looking at each wall. So it's just like single screens. You tap left or right and it just goes and replaces that screen with the other wall. And then you're tapping on objects, interacting, unlocking things. Oh, this, I need a key. Where can I find the key? Oh, here's a box. Open the box. And it's got a code on it. Where can I find the code? I'll look for this thing scrawled on the wall. It's all that business. But fits into the same aesthetic as those weird Rusty Lake games. It's so Twin Peaks, these games. I came to them late. I didn't even know they were a series when I played the last one. Have you played some of these, Em?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. The Rusty Lake games are definitely some of my favourite on mobile.
Okay.
Just because they're weird. And the guys who do it are really nice as well.
I haven't spoken to them, I couldn't say. But yeah, they're definitely massively influenced by Twin Peaks with it all, which I like Twin Peaks, so I'm not going to complain too much. And I was quite engaged in this little... The sort of puzzles made sense. They didn't seem too ridiculous in that point-and-click way that you just have to start rubbing things against other things and hope they work. I wasn't doing that. I was actually guessing based on the clues and the objects. So that's a good sign. It's free to play. I don't know what the payment system is on it, but you can get that right now for iOS and Android. And finally, I guess let's talk Switch business. Xenoblade Chronicles 2 Torna, The Golden Country, came out on Switch this week. And you've played this, Rick.
Mm.
So I'm guessing, have you played like Xenoblade Chronicles 2?
No.
So you're going straight in.
Straight in, totally blind with the, because it's an expansion pack, but it's also a standalone experience.
Yeah. This is your first experience with the Xenoblade Chronicles franchise, full stop?
I played the first one on Wii U.
Okay.
I found it really difficult and way too complex and strange,
because
these games have super weird combat systems.
Yep.
Skipped Xenoblade Chronicles 2 just because I just didn't have time for a 100-hour JRPG, and then had this one for review. It's really difficult to get into if you're not already versed in Xenoblade Chronicles 2, in terms of the story, because it is a direct prequel and it's set 500 years before the events of the main game. So, like, it introduces a bunch of characters, it has a bunch of returning characters, and it kind of is supposed to be filling in their backstories kind of thing. I did end up having to go onto the Xenoblade Chronicles 2 wiki and just double-check what the actual story was, and what any of the terms mean, because it does not explain itself in any way. It fully expects you to have played Xenoblade Chronicles 2. I'm not sure why it's being released as a standalone game, just because it's so complex and it doesn't explain itself. You can kind of pick it up. But, like, the story is just weird and stupid and JRPG nonsense.
I was going to ask, how JRPG is it? Because there's a few standard things which we assume, and, like, yes, you're going to fight through everything, and at the end you'll fight God, and that's how it works. If you're familiar with JRPGs, will you just pick it up and go, oh, yeah, it's one of these?
Yeah.
Or does this franchise do different stuff from the standard?
It's kind of... So the main interesting thing is that it's a mix of, like, fantasy world and then high-tech stuff as well, which has been done before, but it's kind of... It works in this thing. But it does mean that you end up with, like, characters who are digital constructions or something. I don't really know, but obviously because they're not real, they have enormous boobs and don't wear very many clothes and all this kind of, you know, typical JRPG nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, like, you know, really emotional scenes, and then there's just this blonde woman with enormous boobs just going, we should bury these people, they all died in a massacre. It's like, this is not working for me.
That sounds about right. I think Xenoblade 2 was one of those ones that got censored when it was brought over from Japan. I feel like this is one of the ones where the GAF and other people got very, very furious because, like, there was a 14-year-old girl in a big booby outfit and the West was like, yeah, we might want to tone that back. And then internet nerds got very, very cross that they weren't allowed to see an underaged girl's jiggly bits.
I remember it was Xenoblade Chronicles X where you could adjust breast size and that got edited out for the West. And that,
okay.
I think someone got fired over that. Anyway, we can stop talking about all that. We'll talk about the gameplay instead, which is where the game actually is good. So the interesting thing is, so you don't really do fighting. You just kind of enter into combat, and then it does sort of an MMO-style auto-attack stuff. Performing auto-attacks eventually builds up your arts, which is sort of special moves. And then when you use your arts, yeah, that builds up your special meter. which then unlocks even more powerful attacks. And then you can chain together these special moves between the different people in your party kind of thing. So that, it's kind of, you take a back seat almost, and then, but there's some moves you have to use that you have to use in a certain rhythm and at certain times, and they'll have different buffs and debuffs and all this kind of stuff. So all the combat and stuff is really interesting. There's loads of menus to dig into for leveling up and stuff. The leveling up, I believe, has been more streamlined from the main game, but it's still quite interesting. And you get tons and tons of loot for crafting and using as equipment and stuff like that. So there's loads of like good RPG stuff in there in terms of gameplay. The story's a bit weird and a mess and messy, and if you've not played the original game, it doesn't really make any sense. The music's fantastic. I don't think I mentioned this in my review, but the music is absolutely amazing. It's like this weird kind of upbeat jazz with this just this amazing drummer who does not belong in this orchestral jazz thing in the background. It's kind of like playing Birdman the game if it was a JRPG, if anyone's seen Birdman.
Right, okay.
It's like, it's really bizarre music, but it's absolutely fantastic. So yeah, I would say if you've played the original game and you want to play more of it and you've already sunk 100 hours in, you'll probably enjoy it because it's another like 60 hours of extra game for, you know, the price of an expansion pass, which is like £30. If you've not played it and you're interested in playing Xenoblade Chronicles 2, I would suggest playing that first rather than buying this one separately, although I think it's a bit cheaper and the combat is supposedly a lot better. But if you actually want to know what's going on, you should probably play the first game.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because the reason they would package this separately, either A, because it's too big for a download, but that doesn't really matter now because everyone downloads 70 gig and doesn't bat an eyelid. Well, the real reason you package it separately is so people who aren't familiar can play it and buy it as a standalone object. But that's the real test, is does it work as a standalone object if you have no context? Because that's the only reason to have it packaged as a standalone thing. Otherwise, they would just bundle it as a DLC and be like, well, you have to have the original game to download it, obviously. Otherwise, you won't understand what's going on anyway. So playing it as you did, you were still able to enjoy it, but you did feel like you were missing out on stuff.
Yeah, I enjoyed it to an extent.
Right.
And then looking up the story of like the original of Xenoblade Chronicles 2, I realized that the characters I'm playing with are actually hugely important to the main game, and this is going to be like really cool for people who have played the game and loved the story and stuff like that. Whereas I'm like, these characters are a bit silly, this lady's got huge knockers, this is a strange game.
Cool. Rad. Sounds par for the course, though. Okay, of course. So that is out at the very minute, full title being Xenoblade Chronicles 2 Torna - The Golden Country. That'll do. That was a long one, it feels like, to me. So we will be back again next week with more mobile business. So do come back, tune in, drop us a like, smash the subscribe button, batter a pedestrian. I don't know. I'm just running out of nouns.
Throw a comment out the window into moving traffic.
That's it. Upvote your shoes. And we will see you next week for a whole bunch more of this, you lucky people. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
See ya.